Let me just say about Jerry Corsi that this man is a very talented, unusual man. He wrote his first book when he was 16 years old. They paid him to go to graduate school at Harvard. He not only got a full scholarship, he was paid a stipend of $12,000 a year as a favor to Harvard to go there.
That's correct.
He's written many books. He knows a whole lot about a whole bunch of things. And, Jerry, I'd like, and thank you so much for coming. And even though our numbers are few, our influence is not...
It's a great honor to be here.
We're honored to have you. I'd like you to talk later on about Iran, because you wrote a book called Atomic Iran, and you recently predicted that it's only a matter of days before we're at war with Iran.
Yes.
But before we get to that, I'd like you to talk about the North American Union. Tell us about the North American Union, and please begin with a contretemps involving Michael Medved.
Okay. I started writing really about the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America around May 2006. I came onto the topic after working through the book with Jim Gilchrist, who is the founder of the Minutemen. We wrote together a book called Minutemen, The Battle to Secure America's Borders. And in writing that book, the one puzzle that had struck me all the way through was why President Bush would not secure the borders. We knew and documented in the book that there were Hezbollah agents that had bribed their way into the United States from Beirut, Lebanon. They bribed Mexican consular officials. They came across the border with Mexico, and they set up in Dearborn, Michigan. They were sending money back to Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon, and they're now in federal prison. So it made no sense whatsoever that George Bush would have this, you know, publicly declared war on terror as the centerpiece of his administration and would leave the border wide open. And assuming that that was a conscious decision, not simply, you know, something that was overlooked, it required another explanation. And I kept getting pointed to all the people I was interviewing and talking to, including some top experts on immigration policy, continue to refer me to the Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America as the explanation. And when I looked into it, I found that the SPP, as it's called, was declared in Waco, Texas, at a summit meeting on March 23, 2005, with President Bush, Vincente Fox, and Prime Minister Paul Martin of Canada. The nature of the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America was not a law. It was not a treaty. In fact, I can find no document of any kind that was signed, certainly none that has been publicly released. All it was a press conference announcing that this new state of relationships existed between our three countries. And it had evolved from meetings that Vincente Fox had been having prior to 9/11 with George Bush, the very first of which was at his ranch at Guadalajara and down in Mexico. And they then had declared the Prosperity Partnership. After 9/11, it got revised to be the Security and Prosperity Partnership, and it had this formal rolling out and declaration. Now, at the time, it did not appear to be anything of terrible significance. It was presented as neighborly relationships working together cordially. But then, very quickly afterwards, the Department of Commerce created a website, which is spp.gov. And that is a .gov website. It's a Department of Commerce website in which it's fully disclosed that some 30 what are called working groups were going to be constituted between the three nations, and they were going to work in an executive capacity to integrate and harmonize the laws of the United States, Mexico, and Canada. Now, working groups was a kind of a flashing red light, because this is the identical terminology for the bureaucratic entities that currently run the European Union. They're called working groups, and they are constituted in Brussels and Luxembourg of bureaucrats, professional administrators, typically nameless. Sometimes it's even hard to find out who the members of the working group committees are or what the exact number or description of the working groups are in Europe. But these working groups issue directives which then inform the European Parliament as to legislation. And once the European Parliament has passed a law, that informs the legislation of the legislatures of each of the individual countries such that they have to pass or revise their own national laws to be in accordance with the European Union declared law, which originated from the working groups. And now here we have these working groups constituted in the United States. And the working groups, as reported, the first major report on this website was the 2005 Report to Leaders. And that documented that these 20 working groups were being constituted in every area of policy you can think of. Energy, transportation, environment, steel policy, trade policy, textile policy, aviation, border crossing, security and defense, terrorism, internal and external threats. I mean, you go through the list of our U.S. agency departments, and every one of our agency departments will fit into one or more of these working group categories, including Homeland Security and including Department of State. And this 2005 report to the leaders also disclosed that the working groups in each of the three nations were meeting in executive session with formal membership, reporting to three cabinet officers in each government. In our U.S. government, they were reporting to Secretary of State Rice. They were reporting to Department of Homeland Security Chertoff and Secretary Gutierrez in Commerce. Now, about this same time, so March 23rd, 2005, is the declaration, Security and Prosperity Partnership. Right about the time this website is appearing, the Council on Foreign Relations in May 2005 issues a task force report entitled Building a North American Community. And this task force had been meeting and reporting, again, little noticed, since 2001, since before 9/11. The report, which was called Building a North American Community, claimed internally to the report to be a blueprint for SPP, the working model out of which SPP was generated. And one of the co-chairmen of this task force was Robert Pastor, a professor at American University, who for at least 10 years has been actively writing about North American integration. In fact, the title of his 2001 book was Toward a North American Community, that exact phrase reappearing, you know, Building a North American Community in the Council on Foreign Relations report. Robert Pastor's history, in the Carter administration, he was on the Linowitz Commission, and he had strongly recommended that the Panama Canal be given to Panama. He was subsequently on the National Security Council of the Carter administration and appointed to lead the negotiation that resulted in the treaty where the canal was handed to Panama. Jesse Helms was so angry at Robert Pastor for doing this that when Bill Clinton subsequently nominated Robert Pastor to be our ambassador to Panama, Jesse Helms refused to allow the discussion of the issue to come to the floor of the Senate. And Pastor's career began with the Institute of Policy Studies, where he first began writing reports on Latin America. And, of course, we all know that to be a essentially communist front organization founded by Cora Weiss with Fabergé money, that in studies done of it, including most recently David Horowitz's studies, has been very well identified as a KGB front and fully infiltrated by KGB. Robert Pastor began his career there. And I would also note that the Institute of Policy Studies currently has on its website a number of articles and other endorsements of SPP and the whole concept of building a North American community. That theme has continued even with the Institute of Policy Studies. Now, what this report called for, Council on Foreign Relations report, was that by 2010, we would have created enough institutional structures in North America to advance the agenda to economic and political integration. These institutions included a parliamentary structure, taking the current interparliamentary groups that we have operating with Canada and Mexico and advancing them to really being a parliamentary-type structure, taking the Chapter 11 tribunals that are in NAFTA today and advancing them to a North American permanent court structure that would resolve trade disputes and other disputes between the three nations, and evolving a council which was identified as 15 appointed members, none of them elected, five from each of the three countries, who would act as an advisory group, essentially the beginning of an executive branch structure of appointed leaders. The other types of institutions that were called for was the creation of a North American Development Fund to develop Mexico, to bring up Mexico's status, and a whole series of intergovernmental tying together where, for instance, we would no longer have the border with Mexico or the border with Canada protected, but the only border protected would be a perimeter around North America to the point where our immigration and enforcement authorities would be combined in a continental immigration enforcement control authority with Mexico and Canada, whose objective would be to screen people entering North America. Once they were here, the goal was open migration of people, open migration of labor, and open movement of capital. That's what the Council on Foreign Relations report called for. Now, as you see the structuring develop within the SPP.gov, these working groups are beginning to issue memorandum of understanding and other agreements between the three nations that are not subsequently published. And I launched a Freedom of Information Act request, and a separate one was launched by Judicial Watch, Tom Fitton's organization. I received 1,000 pages of documentation, and it included a formal organizational chart. This organizational chart identified these working groups in boxes, you know, below a line that had them reporting to the three cabinet secretaries. And then I was surprised to find at the next level of reporting, they reported to the Homeland Security Council and to the National Security Council. And the next level of reporting was to the President of the United States. Now, that was a formal organizational chart of working groups that are nowhere defined in the Constitution, nowhere defined in legislation, and are operating as a shadow bureaucracy. We also received the lists of the bureaucrats in each of the three countries by name, telephone number, agency, and email address who were assigned to each of the working groups. So in addition to the organizational chart, I can now tell you the membership, the organizational membership of these working groups, which is a set of bureaucrats taken from the various departments of the United States government and the executive branch, working together with Mexico and Canada. And for some of these working groups, now documented in a 2006 report on SPP.gov, there have been as many as 8 to 10 meetings over a two-year period of time scheduled and held within each of the three countries. And in the 2005 and 2006 report to the leaders, they are defining a whole series of policy milestones and redefinitions. I'm going to give you just a couple of them, and I'm going to hand around. This is their 2006 published book, which I was sent last week by various congressional committees in Washington who are beginning to follow SPP.gov at our encouragement. And as you'll see as I pass this around, it's about a 300-page printed book. There's a comparable one for 2005. The book, in each of the policy areas, lists milestones of integration and harmonization of our laws. It lists the milestones of new agreements being signed and memorandum of understanding, and it gives dates for accomplishment of these objectives. It's published in full color in three languages. Each of the governments published this and copyrighted. Canada specifically copyrights it. And SPP.gov says on the website that it's just a dialogue, but as you read this, I defy anyone to see this as just a dialogue of cooperation. This is the structure, right here, of the administrative law and regulatory framework that will evolve into a North American Union. On the same stealth plan that in Europe was used to emerge from a coal and steel agreement first conceived at the end of World War One.
Really?
Yes. The original origin of it was World War One. The book that Bill Ball has right there, The Great Deception, is probably the best written and most thoroughly documented book on the subject. Jean Monnet began right after World War One on the presumption that World War One had come about because Germany was able to mobilize the coal and steel industries of Europe for war production to advance its nationalistic aims to take over Europe. And the concept was that if nationalism could be destroyed, we would have no more European wars led by Germany trying to dominate the continent, which became an even more manifest idea after the Second World War, and it happened a second time. So the concept was to start controlling the steel and coal industry so they could not be turned to armaments in the service of one nation. But now Jean Monnet, in his memoirs, which we have available, now printed, openly discusses that it was always a stealth plan. Those who put it together realized they could never openly state their objectives to destroy the nation states of Europe, or it would have been rejected. Instead, they chose to put in pieces in place incrementally so that after a steel and coal agreement was realized, the 1957 Treaty of Rome, which set up the common market, would become more acceptable. And once a common market was in place and there were trade disputes, then it would make more sense in 1999 to advance to the Treaty of Maastricht, which evolved the European Union as a regional government. Once the European government was in place, it made sense to evolve to 2002, where the euro replaced the individual currencies. But all the way along, those advancing this plan could deny that they were after a European regional agreement that would ultimately destroy national sovereignty. That was the nature of the stealth plan, even though the intellectual architects had begun there as their full and consciously realized purpose. So the argument is that what we have now and we are able to demonstrate is the implementation of the same plan in the United States, Mexico, and Canada to evolve the United States, Mexico, and Canada into a North American Union. And Robert Pastor, a few economists in Canada, have even described the currency which will end up emerging as the Amero, a counterpart to the euro. So the entire structure of where we're headed is fully disclosed, even though the purpose stated is that we now have a North American community. I want to hand this book around.
How many copies of that, Jerry?
I only have one. I published today in WorldNet Daily an article about this with a photograph of these books. I gave the telephone number, the email, and the address of Jerry Word, the Department of Commerce, who manages SPP.gov, And I'm hoping that thousands of people call her for copies, because all of her information is published today on WorldNet Daily. I didn't pay a thing for it. Of course, it was sent to me by the congressional committees. I have no idea what they're charging or if they're charging. Now, this idea of a North American community I want to spend a few minutes on because it's important. Our pastor has defined in his book, under the same title, that, and I've interviewed him recently, and he's denied, of course, that he wants to go to a North American union. He says, right now. And the right now is the critical qualification, because the argument is that we are not yet ready as three nations to move into a regional political government. The European community, remember, preceded the European Union. So too, a North American community is designed to precede a North American Union. The idea is that we must begin to think, act, live, and work as North Americans, not as U.S. citizens. And if you look at this SPP report to the government, to the leaders, which is now printed from 2005 and 2006, you'll see that everything is North American. We now have a North American energy policy, a North American environment policy, a North American transportation policy, all of which our bureaucrats have agreed to put into place without printing the documents and fully superseding the U.S. energy policy, the U.S. environmental policy, and the U.S. transportation policy. I want to point to two of the specific areas which I think are most illustrative. SPP is in the process of instituting Trusted Traveler and Trusted Trader biometric border pass cards, which will be issued this year in 2007. Trusted Traveler means that anyone could go to the SPP.gov offices. In Mexico, any citizen can apply. And unless you do not meet the specifications, which have not yet been published, but appear to be that you haven't committed some egregious criminal offense, you'll be issued a biometric Trusted Traveler card. And that card will authorize you to go through a border crossing location and to use that card, swipe it through the machines as easily as you would swipe a credit card through a grocery store credit card checkout machine to leave with groceries. And then you walk into the United States. You are no longer an illegal alien. You are now a trusted North American traveler who has the right to be, live, and work anywhere you want to be, live, or work in North America. Similarly, on our border crossing locations, trusted trader fast lanes are being established. And as these documents now printed indicate, fast lanes, you may have seen them, are being put into our border crossing locations all across the border with Mexico and all across the border with Canada. They've just shown up. No one has hardly given them any thought. They are FAST lanes, and they're like an HOV lane on an interstate, Easy Pass. If you have the appropriate electronic identification, so let's say you are a trucking company in Mexico, you can have applied for and gotten a trusted trader set of biometrics that you can put into your trucks and give to your drivers. So when they pass the border, it's simply an electronic scan, and they come across no more than as if it were a speed bump, again, like an easy pass on a interstate. And no one will look inside the truck or the train. Now, drug cartels in Mexico have been buying trucking companies for a decade to launder cash. We're going to ignore that. If their trucking companies identified as a trusted trader, supposedly will have all the identification, their RFID, radio frequency ID chip will be read, and in they pass on the fast lanes. Now, as I've said, this is in effect erasing the borders. It doesn't actually erase the border. The border with Mexico is still there, but it becomes like a European border. If you have a European Union passport, you'll be stopped at the border likely and questioned or made to show a passport, but it will be, in effect, no stop, just to be to recognize it. You'll have a right to enter. And the same is being done to our border with Mexico and our border with Canada right now. We've also, the aviation working groups, have identified an objective which they've gotten. And by the way, the content analysis, the language for the Council on Foreign Relations report, Building a North American Community, or Robert Pastor's books and writings, of which there are many, including his speeches to Congress, testimony, or his speeches to groups like the Trilateral Commission, which are in print. The language of those is identical in many instances to the language showing up at spp.gov. So, for instance, while the Council on Foreign Relations argues that we should have open skies to the point where a Mexican airline could just as easily deliver routes and establish both passenger and cargo from Los Angeles to Chicago without any intent to enter into Mexico on that route, as we could have as our airlines established to handle Mexican locations without interfacing with the United States. In other words, Mexico City ought to just become another North American destination without regard to it being a separate nation. And in the last 2 years, we have taken our GPS system for commercial and military aircraft and shared it with Mexico and Canada and built wide area augmentation systems in Mexico and Canada, so Mexico and Canadian air traffic controllers today can use all tools available to a U.S. traffic controller in a U.S. city, including recognition and identification of any military aircraft over the continental United States. We've already done that. I've been in numerous congressional offices, and I have yet to find a single congressman or senator who has studied any of what SPP is doing, who has looked at these documents until we've written about them, and even then their staffs are not in detail knowledgeable of what's going on. I want to shift to a related topic, which has been going on simultaneously, and that is the construction of NAFTA superhighways. The first really major NAFTA superhighway that we're going to have is the I-35 corridor, stretching from Laredo, Texas, up through the heart of Texas, Dallas, going by San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, up to Oklahoma City, to Kansas City, and on up into Duluth, where it connects with Canadian highways, which stretch both east and west in Canada to both coasts. Now, a trade organization called NASCO, N-A-S-C-O, which stands for the North American Super Corridor Coalition, Inc., which is headquartered in Dallas, has been operating for about 10 years and has put together the various departments of transportation along this route and other related companies, and has gotten federal earmark money, the tune of several million dollars, to implement the I-35 corridor as an international trade corridor. The Trans-Texas Corridor, which is going to be built in Texas, and you can go to another government website, which is keeptexasmoving.com. It's a Texas Department of Transportation website, has identified that there will be begun to be built in 2007 a new 4-football-field-wide highway, railroad, pipeline corridor parallel to Interstate 35, new construction. It will stretch from Laredo right up through, bypassing San Antonio, bypassing Austin, bypassing Dallas, and heading to be completed at the border just south of Oklahoma City. This highway is going to be financed by Cintra of Spain, C-I-N-T-R-A. They're a Spanish investment consortium with ties to the Juan Carlos family. Cintra's put in and already has gotten all the contracts signed for this. The construction will proceed by eminent domain, which will proceed to confiscate homes, businesses, farms, etc., even though the ultimate purpose of the road will be to lease it to a private entity, which is Sintra in Spain, for at least 50 years. And the Texas Department of Transportation has announced the intention to build 4,000 miles of these trans-Texas corridors, crisscrossing Texas, over the next 50 years. They will eat up 584,000 acres of land and displace an estimated 1 million Texans from their current homes, farms, ranches, etc. Now, the purpose of this road is disclosed in the Kansas City SmartPort website, another trade organization, which has defined Kansas City as an inland port. Now, last time I was in Kansas City, I don't recall seeing any major body of water that would justify the identification of Kansas City as an inland port, except when you realize, as is fully disclosed in the Kansas City SmartPort website, the port involves Lázaro Cárdenas or Manzanilla, which are two Mexican ports on the Pacific coast of Mexico. And the intention is that the cargo ships from the Far East and China will land at Manzanilla and Lázaro Cárdenas, where they will be unloaded by Mexican dock workers and taken on Mexican trucks and Mexican trains through Laredo, Texas, where they will enter the Trans-Texas Corridor, or I-35, until TTC is completely built, and head up towards Kansas City. Kansas City is putting in a Mexican customs office on Kansas City soil to accommodate Mexico. Mexico has refused to pay for it. Kansas City City Council has agreed that the taxpayers of Kansas City will pay $3 million to put this facility in. And contrary to what the City Council and Kansas City SmartPort have told the taxpayers, the State Department is indicating that this will most likely have to be Mexican sovereign soil. So we'll have a Mexican sovereign soil customs office established in the heart of the United States. Now, the purpose of this plan is the following. NAFTA did not develop Mexico as promised. At the height of NAFTA, on the border, the maquiladoras, the sweatshop assembly and manufacturing plants, had about 3 million workers in the 1990s. But increasingly, that has gone to China, as has our manufacturing and assembly gone to China. And today, the Chinese are bringing their goods in containers into West Coast ports, such as Long Beach and Los Angeles. But there are several problems with this. One, those ports have longshoremen, which are union workers, expensive to unload. Second, with the volume of containers coming in, those ports are overwhelmed. Third, the transportation costs are still high because more than half of the goods delivered on the West Coast are intended for the center of the country or the East Coast, and that involves a lot of transportation. Right now, the larger post-Panamax ships being built, post-Panamax referring to too big to fit through the Panama Canal, coming from China and the Far East, have to enter the Suez Canal if they are to come to the Atlantic coast of the United States. That's too costly. Bringing the container ships, which are now planned to be as many as holding as many as 12,500 containers, which I assure you is three times the biggest container ship you've ever seen. It's like moving two city blocks of 16-story tall skyscrapers around the world. These ships will take a week to unload, and the cranes required to unload them have to be nearly 20 stories high. The ports have to be deep water ports. So Lázaro Cárdenas and Manzanilla qualify. By bringing the containers into Lázaro Cárdenas, It's only a few more days, maybe two more days sailing, maybe three from the west coast of the United States, which is a lot cheaper than transporting those goods in trucks with Teamsters or trains with United Transportation workers over land. When they get up this corridor in Texas to Kansas City, Kansas City will be a main switching location for east and west. But additional north-south corridors are planned all through the United States. There's also an intent to develop on the Baja, Punta Colonet, which is another Mexican port, which would feed a corridor already identified as the Canamex Corridor, C-A-N-A-M-E-X, and a coalition organized around it, which would have one route going up the western side of the Rocky Mountains, heading towards destinations like Salt Lake City, and the other coming up called Camino Royal, coming up Colorado and heading up that side of the Rocky Mountains. Then, as the Panama Canal gets deepened and widened, which there is now a proposal to do, then ports such as in Miami, Jacksonville, will be deepened and widened. And there's already formed an I-95 corridor coalition, which is to replicate the Trans-Texas Corridor plan along I-95, anticipating that containers in huge volumes will be brought in from China. Because remember, China has actual slave goods. China yet has concentration camps of political prisoners which produce goods for the United States market. They pay the workers nothing. In fact, in documented cases, when the people are no longer useful in the concentration camp, they're sold for their organs, which are placed by the Chinese on the international organ market. Then if you can't get slave labor, you can get near slave labor. And I assure you that virtually everything made, sold in a Walmart or Kmart or Home Depot, is made by near slave labor in China. Near slave labor means typically a manufacturing or assembly plant of 4 to 10,000 workers who are paid no more than 35 or 40 cents an hour, are forced to live in dormitories where they are charged for their food and their rent, and penalized monetary amounts for infractions, and fired when they're 20. Because there's another group of younger, down to 13-year-old workers who are available to come in and replace them. So make no mistake that this will build a Chinese middle class. It does not. And
excuse me, where do you get the documentation on that particular?
That one in particular was documented by one of the human rights groups I cited in the articles on Human Events and WorldNet Daily. In fact, there have been several really good case studies done. New Balance sneakers. There were photographs brought out of this factory and plants. There's about a 50-page fully documented with photographs reports on the China Labor Watch website. It was also done for Puma, P-U-M-A, sneakers, another fully documented one, plus several toy manufacturers that make toys for, among other things, McDonald's or other toys that are sold as premium items in the United States. These have been fully documented. People have smuggled out photographs and documentations, including work slips and other material which document these plants' existence.
Let's hold questions until Jerry finishes.
Okay, now, the idea that it was wrong to use African-American slaves, but it's not wrong to use Chinese slaves because they're just little yellow people with slanted eyes and we can't see them, is absurd. It was morally wrong to use African-American slaves. It was morally wrong, and is today, to use Chinese slaves, and it's a disgrace that we allow it to happen. It's also wrong and stupid economically because it does invite all manufacturing to leave North America. And currently, in fact, just within the past 2 months, there's been another round of plant closings announced in Detroit and automakers. And Chrysler has just formed deals to manufacture its first cars in China for import into the United States market. I would say that within one generation, there will be no manufacturing whatsoever left in the continental United States of any significance. It will all go to China. Our trade deficit to China now is over $280 billion and growing. Last month, in December, it reached a new record height. China has $1 trillion in foreign exchange resources, reserves, the most ever. $700 billion of that is held in U.S. dollar-denominated assets, half of which, about $350 billion, are in Treasury securities. We finance our huge and growing deficits, budget deficits, by selling Treasury securities into the foreign exchange market. When China announced prior to Thanksgiving 2006 that it was going to hold fewer dollar-denominated assets, the dollar began taking another nosedive. That's when we sent five cabinet secretaries, led by Secretary Paulson of the Treasury, whom I call Mr. China, for having become a multi-godzillionaire while working at Goldman Sachs, where his major purpose in life was to do trade deals with Chinese companies, bring U.S. delegations over, trade delegations to China, and to have Goldman Sachs invest in Chinese companies.
He also arranged with the government of Sudan to get PetroChina control of much of the oil in southern Sudan.
Correct. Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke went on that trade mission. The Chinese listened politely to our request that they allow their yuan, their currency, to freely float, and they politely told us no way. It would not happen. The United States, I will also make one other point here for reference. On December 15, 2006, the United States government, Department of Treasury, released the 2006 financial report of the United States government, which since about 2001, Congress has mandated be recorded once a year on a GAAP basis, generally accepted accounting practices, not on a cash basis. When you hear that the U.S. has a constantly reducing deficit of $284 billion, that's on a cash basis. Cash basis means any tax revenue that comes in for whatever purpose is allocated to whatever liabilities the federal government currently has to pay without consideration to the net present value of future obligations that are currently being incurred, such as Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. GAAP accounting, federal deficit, according to the U.S. Treasury, December 15, 2006, fully accounting for the net present value of future obligations incurred in 2006 for Social Security and Medicare, is not $286 or $4 billion. It's $4.6 trillion with a T. To establish a negative net worth of the United States, currently at $53 trillion negative net worth, which could not be resolved by taxing 100% of all corporate profits and wages, taking them all, confiscating them, would not solve this problem even if it were done for a number of years. It is a more than a technical bankruptcy. It's an inability to pay off these future obligations without monetarizing the dollar, meaning you may get your $3,000 Social Security check. By the time you get it, good luck trying to buy a hamburger and a cup of coffee with that $3,000. That's what monetizing the debt means. All right, so to resume the NAFTA story, you have in place now these NAFTA corridors and NASCO. Oh, by the way, one other point that's critical here is that ports like Lazaro Cardenas, Manzanilla, Punta Colonet, and both ends of the Panama Canal are now being operated by Hutchison Whampoa, which is a communist Chinese company with ties to the Chinese military. Okay, so that's now we're allowing the Chinese to manage these entry points into North America.
Let me mention that General Sumner and I, and Bill, you may have been with us, visited the Hutchison Whampoa facility at Balboa in Panama. And we saw the extraordinary size of the Hutchinson Juan Polo contingent. But more interesting, we visited the adjacent properties and saw how Hutchinson Juan Polo was essentially forcing all of the neighboring facilities out of business so that they could take them over and have complete control of every bit of land, including a major ship repair facility, the only significant ship repair facility in the Atlantic and the Pacific, where U.S. naval vessels have in the past been serviced, now controlled by Communist China.
That's right.
Outrageous.
Now, and
of course, all of this being facilitated by the Bush administration.
Bush administration. Also, NASSCO, the trade association I mentioned earlier in Dallas for the North American Super Corridor Coalition, has just concluded a contract with Lockheed Martin to put RFID sensors all up and down the corridor of I-35 with RFID chips in all the containers entering from Communist China and the Far East, so they can be tracked all up and down the corridor. Now, the joint venture company that Lockheed has created to do this, Lockheed bought a company that was in a joint venture with Hutchinson Juan Polo. So Hutchinson Juan Polo will now have direct access, 49% ownership, to the electronic tracking company that will track all container traffic entering the North American corridors from ports in Mexico. All the data and all of this SPP facilitated data tracking of movement of people and cargo through North America is heavily reliant on electronics. There's going to be no opening of anything, no opening of containers. If you've got a trusted traveler, biometrics card, a trusted trader, and an RFID chip that's recognized by the Hutchinson Juan Polo tracking system, you'll be recorded, they'll know exactly where you are, and you'll be able to move freely within North America without having anything opened or examined or checked.
You know, you could talk about the intelligence capabilities of the United States, but Communist China will have the capacity to know more about everything than any element of our government or populace will have, whether it relates to drugs, human cargo, weaponry, technology, whatever it may be. We will be totally at the mercy of the Communist Chinese because of the treasonous decisions being made by our elected officials and their subordinates.
And it invites us to take a look at the fact that I believe that currently the drug trade for Mexico has become Mexico's largest business. I think it's well over a $250 billion business right now today. And I believe that not only the government of Mexico but others are planning to participate in this off-the-books revenue. And this tracking system would facilitate the identification and movement of all drugs along this corridor. Also, by the way, the drug cartels in Mexico have put the drug distribution system in place in the United States with our open borders. It's MS-13, the tattooed El Salvadorian gang, which the FBI told us in writing Minutemen is now in 3,000 American communities and out of control. They distribute drugs and steal cars. Also, any explosive, nuclear device, or any other kind of device put into one of these containers with the data available in the RFID chips could not only be tracked to its precise location within North America, but it could also be detonated electronically from some distant location. Continuing on this theme, we've documented a number of the secret meetings are continuing. I received word that a council, the North American Forum on Integration, was holding a meeting in Banff, Alberta, Canada, and Mel Hertig, a very well-known Canadian politician and author, sent to me the list of the attendees and the agenda of this conference, and gave us an interview on it, which I published in WorldNet Daily. And the sponsors of this were George Schulte. George Schulte, former Reagan administration Secretary of State. It was being headed by equally prominent Canadians and Mexicans.
Carla Hills was there.
Carla Hills is the woman who negotiated the NAFTA treaty for George H.W. Bush.
She also sold out Jonas Savimbi in Angola.
That's right. And she also was on the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force co-chaired by Robert Pastor. She was on that task force. Carla Hills attended this meeting, North American Integration, Foreman Integration. Our State Department officials attended it. I took the name one of the people in the State Department who is Western Hemisphere, Deputy Secretary. His office confirmed that he did attend the meeting, that he did chair the panel where Robert Pastor spoke, and the State Department refused to give us the list of the other, of who attended the panel or the paper. They would not give us the paper that Dr. Pastor delivered. They wouldn't affirm or deny whether the State Department official agreed or disagreed with Dr. Pastor, though I made the argument it wouldn't make sense that he chaired a paper that he disagreed with. And the U.S. taxpayers paid for the State Department official to attend the meeting. A Wall Street Journal reporter attended the meeting on the condition she not write any stories about it. Okay, so, and another meeting of those, that meeting is held once a year in each of the countries, and another meeting is scheduled here next year. And we have the dates and locations of when that meeting is scheduled. And we published the attendees and the agenda. As to the Amero, I interviewed Robert Pastor recently, and after he had given an interview in Spanish to a Spanish publication, and he had said in Spanish, I guess he thought none of us would read Spanish, I don't know why he presumed that, but he said that all it would take is a 9/11 crisis, and the next one would probably be what was needed to advance where it needs to go, the North American integration agenda. He was lamenting that Mexico has a government that will not be as strong as Vicente Fox, opposed by the left. Canada has a minority government, and George Bush is a lame duck. And in that interview, again, Dr. Pastor said, no, I don't want a North American Union right now. But again, the suggestion would be, and the suggestions were, that the kind of an economic crisis that might be building with the looming, continuing devaluation of the dollar. It's also been announced within the last month that there are now more euros in circulation than dollars, the first time ever in history. The dollar is number two of a currency in circulation. And central banks all over the world are reducing their foreign exchange dependence on the dollar. Iran has announced that it will do no international transactions, including in oil, in the dollar. I've written that this was the same type of move that Saddam Hussein made to sign his death warrant when he got the United Nations to agree he could hold his oil for food, foreign reserve exchange holdings in euros. But a crisis that could be building easily, calling for devaluation of the dollar, would be made on the following argument, that to compete with Europe and the euro, we need to value into a regional currency the oil of Mexico, the cheap labor of Mexico, which could move here as a permanent, for the foreseeable future, source of labor, which would undermine unions of the middle class at the lower-paying job skills, and the resources of Canada, which include extensive oil in Alberta and the oil sands, abundant fresh water, timber, and other minerals. Because the United States now is being declared mineral deficient, which would be solved by combining with Canada and Mexico, and too expensive in terms of middle-income labor, which would be solved by undermining the U.S. labor market by an abundant supply of Mexican cheap, uneducated labor to form a permanent underclass within the United States, with the vision to the market next opening to CAFTA, and one way or the other to a free trade association or grouping of the Americas, where the North American Union could be expanded into a Western Hemisphere Union, which ultimately over a 50 or so year horizon would more than compete with the European Union. Texas and the roads in Texas are going to be so built in their infrastructure because it's going to be viewed as one of the main entry points for all of the produce and other goods that will be grown in Central America and South America and shipped into the United States as land in the United States, which is used for farming, is abandoned, and the United States carved up into these corridors, which will be paved north-south, about 4 to 6 of them all across, up and down the United States, across the continent. That's the vision, in a nutshell, that is well along the way. I'll add one last point, and then I'll answer questions. The North American Development Fund was introduced into legislation by Senator John Cornyn of Texas. Robert Pastor, I now have the photographs of John Cornyn attending Robert Pastor seminars at American University, and I'm convinced that he consciously entered that piece of legislation on behalf of Robert Pastor, even though his staff denied it at the time. It was when I called called Senator Cornyn's office and pointed out to his staff that he was introducing a key piece of the Council on Foreign Relations, Robert Pastor's plan to create a North American Union, that Senator Cornyn decided to withdraw the legislation or not advance it. And I told the Senate staff at that time that I'd done a content analysis, and I pointed them out word for sentence, concept by concept, where what the senator introduced was identical to what the Council on Foreign Relations and Robert Pastor had been calling for, which is a coincidence that could not have occurred by chance. Now I can validate it didn't, because I have the photographs of Cornyn at Pastor seminars. That's the extent to which this thinking has advanced and continues to advance under the Bush administration, putting in place the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America, with the plan being, as I said, the incremental plan in Europe. So now we've gone from NAFTA, Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America, with the next step being the North American Community, to be followed by the North American Union, with the appropriate crisis justifying putting in place the AMERL.
Dr. Corsi, we thank you for the extraordinary work you have done with such precision and skill. I hope that everyone listening to this recording will recognize the importance of the information that Dr. Corsi has provided to us at this meeting of the Board of Trustees of the Conservative Caucus Foundation. I hope everyone listening will appreciate the fact that this is not only a number one priority for the Conservative Caucus Foundation to educate the American people concerning this looming threat, but it ought to be your priority and the priority of every person listening. We cannot be effective in mounting an educational campaign concerning the North American Union, the North American Community, the AMERO, the Security and Prosperity Partnership without necessary funding. If you have listened to this recording and share my profound concern for the future liberty and independence of the American Republic, my prayer is that you will make the largest possible contribution you can afford, and it's tax deductible, to the Conservative Caucus Foundation. Mark it NAU for North American Union, NAU-TCCF, and send it to us at TCCF, the Conservative Caucus Foundation, 450 Maple Avenue East, Vienna, Virginia, 22180.